House Committee on Healthcare to order for this 15th of May, and I'm going to open a public hearing, at least for the purpose of taking some testimony from Senator Beyer on Senate Bill 413. Senator, will you join us, please? You have somebody else you want to bring with?
Looks like we have another senator here on the same bill.
Same bill, okay.
Same bill.
We can share.
Senators already.
Yeah.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lori Monta Sanderson, State Senator for Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview. And I just wanted to give you a little bit of background on Senate Bill 413. It really does provide another tool for Oregon consumers to be actively involved in the rate filing process for health insurance. And as you know, I consider the most excellent review process in the nation here, very open to consumers being able to know what's going on with their premiums. We really had to work hard on this bill, and we did meet the advocates and opponents to this bill. We had a work group, and then we actually struggled many, many times in trying to come to a bill that we could get somewhat consensus. So that's where it's at regarding that. But we do have, I want you to remember, if you consider changing it, that'll be very difficult on the Senate side. So I don't know how, if you will change it, but I want you to know that we do have the gold standard nationwide. It's transparent, it's consumer friendly, and it's interactive, and you know, consumers have been facing double digit increases in rates, and so I feel strongly that it's very important for the public to have access to rate filings and the rate review process. Basically, what 413A does is it requires insurance carriers to notify their members at least annually how the policyholder may sign up to receive information from DCBS about rate filings. And now, you know, with the Cover Oregon and Exchange, the rate filings are all going to be pretty much the same time every year in April, May. So it isn't like it was before for consumers where rate filings could be throughout the year. It will be pretty much in the spring. The website, the Insurance Division website, is extremely powerful tool, and I have actually gone to it and used it. It's very user-friendly, and we just need to let the consumers know how they can access that. Again, I just want to say that the A and Gross version is a compromise, and we worked very hard on the Senate after getting several carriers and Osberg and SAIU around the table. I do believe it's an important step toward transparency without dramatically increasing costs to the consumer during this important time of healthcare transformation. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I have the privilege of representing the good people of Central Linn and Lane Counties in the State Senate. And I'm here today to express strong support for this bill. I only wish it was a little stronger. You know, buying health insurance is one of the most complicated and expensive purchases that our citizens make. Frankly, that's why state law currently subjects insurance rates to the oversight of the insurance commissioner. Anyone who has bought health insurance or watched the rising cost of health insurance certainly understands why there is concern among the public that what they're buying is fairly priced. That's why I think it's important for the consuming public to have the right to express their concerns on the proposed rates to the commissioner as that rate is underway. However, it doesn't do any good to provide an opportunity for comment if the consumers are not made aware of the proposed rate hikes. That's why Senate Bill 413 is important. It requires an insurance company that is proposing a significant rate increase to advise their consumers that they have a rate increase pending, that the consumer be told where they can get information about the proposal, and how they can submit comments. I think this is a common sense and frankly, a business-friendly requirement. You know, as someone who spent a decade as the state's chief utility regulator, it's not lost on me that our utility rates are subjected to considerably more review and intervention than insurance rates are. And yet, the utility rates, at best, are only about a quarter to a third of the cost of the insurance rates that most consumers pay. I think it makes sense to increase the scrutiny, particularly as we move forward and nationally and in Oregon require everybody to have insurance. I think it's make sure that that requirement is met with a fairly priced product and is subjected to reasonable review. Frankly, if I had my own way, I would probably encourage you to include an intervener in the process, someone, a trained professional, to help them as I experienced in the utility field. But as the good senator from Gresham said, that was something that was lost in the discussion to move the bill forward that you have. So I hope you consider this well and the amendment you have and pass something out. I think it's an important thing for Oregonians to have this kind of protection. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have to answer any questions.
Any questions? We are not going to work this today. We're taking testimony in the public hearing. We do have three amendments or something to be considered, and we'll keep you informed as we're moving along. And we've already had at least one conference committee. There's no reason we can't have a few more before we go forward.
Thank you.
You were very kind in the last time. We can perhaps be kind in this one. We can talk on it.
All right.
Good. Well, thank you both very much
for
coming.
All right. Thank you.
If we don't have any other senators here, then we'll let's just keep going with some witnesses on this same bill. Would you call the first panel? And ask you guys to be brief. If you have written testimony, please submit it. We have a lot of work to do between now and the last day of the month.
Felisa Haggins, John Powell, and Stephen Michael.
This is the real John Powell now, is that right? He's not listening. Is that right? This is the real John Powell?
Yes.
Not that fakey one you sent in the last time?
John W.
Not John W. Please. Felisa, you want to try?
Sure. I'll do my best. I'm here to, for the record, I'll start there. For the record, my name is Felisa Haggins. I'm here today representing SEIU Local 49 and SEIU Local 503. We represent 65,000 workers in the state of Oregon combined. About 20,000 of those we believe will be purchasing their health care through the health insurance exchange or currently get their health care in the individual and small group markets. We also operate in all of the other healthcare arenas. We are a large purchaser of healthcare. We have employer-sponsored healthcare, and we operate a Taft-Hartley Trust. So just to let you know that we're playing in all of the healthcare fields, and we're very committed to making healthcare reform work and making sure that every person in the state of Oregon has access to affordable health care. So I'm going to walk through just generally what we think about Senate Bill 413. And we were, I would say, a little bit disappointed with the changes that came on the Senate side. We'd like to see the rate review process continue to be strengthened in the state of Oregon. I think we continuously hear that we have the strongest rate review process in the country. In my opinion, that's no reason not to make it better. We also are seeing double-digit premium requests. So I think the first part is the Dash 7 amendments. We would really like to see the insurance industry be more proactive on their outreach to consumers regarding their request for rate filing so that they could be active in the DCBS process. I think direct outreach before when the rate is filed so that consumers know they have an outlet to challenge the rate, that they're clear about where they can sign up, is important for us, and I think important to have more people engaged in the process. And so we'll be supporting the Dash 7 amendments. I'm unclear if you have the amendments in front of you.
Yeah.
You have them. Great. Okay.
That one.
The next set of amendments that you have is the issue of medical trend. We would like, you know, we're under the complete understanding that it's not the insurance industry that completely drives the cost increases in their rates. We're sympathetic to that. We know that they are paying bills based on claims data that's coming in from hospitals, large providers, et cetera. In our state, though, we've decided to go a different way. We've decided on the coordinated care organizations to set a fixed rate of growth that we can manage to a global budget and really go after what medical trend is in Medicaid. We believe that some of these principles can be applied to commercial insurance and that our rate review processes can be a critical part of that. With the work of DCBS and the Oregon Health Authority, they should develop medical trend, come up with that number, and have insurance companies try to meet that number in their medical trend line. Clearly, there's a process in the amendments that if the insurers believe that they cannot meet that trend line, then they can file a greater rate, et cetera. But DCBS would work with them and the Oregon Health Authority to really help lower costs there. One of the things that we've heard from the from DCBS is that when the rate filings and when you see a rate filing, you see a long list of cost containment items that are listed when the insurance industry is asked for cost containment items. There's a long laundry list. There's no evaluation process of which of those items on that list are effective or ineffective, which of those items are they're moving forward aggressively, which of those items they have sort of some pilot projects in, et cetera. We believe that under the cost containment list that they can work with the Oregon Health Authority and DCBS to implement effective programs to control costs that have been implemented across other lines of business and with other payers. And so DCBS should have the right to refuse rates based on that list of cost containment concepts. And so I think those are the amendments that you have in front of you. And with that, I'll close, but I'm happy to take questions.
There will be a dash 8 soon, which is an amendment that I produced that will require DCBS to develop in a public way a standard medical inflation rate to use across all filings. So that allows the insurance companies to start at the same place and then argue for modifications of that rate based on their own. That'll be a dash 8, and it'll be, you know, it's probably later today.
And we are incredibly supportive of that concept.
So for people who may not know this, the dash 7 has to do with the outreach to consumers, and the dash 8 has to do with the medical trend.
Yeah.
And it is in OLS.
Okay.
Is the dash 8 in OLS?
It is, at least for staff, for member. Okay. I don't know if it is to the public, but it is for...
Chair Greenlight, members of committee.
No, 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 no,
I'm sorry for the confusion. I don't think we have those any of these amendments yet, but we're
I just got
speaking to the
a
concept.
Few minutes ago,
so, thank you.
Okay.
Chair Greenlight, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak on this matter. My name is Stephen Michael. I'm an organizer with Main Street Alliance Borgen. We are a statewide network of over 1,200 small businesses across Oregon who encourage our owners to speak out on issues that impact small business and our communities as a whole. Here today in support of Senate Bill 413, specifically in support of the Dash 2 amendments that were offered by the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection. As one of our key areas of focus at Main Street Alliance is healthcare reform, we've advocated for and defended the Affordable Care Act and the formation of Cover Oregon, the insurance exchange. Members of our executive team sit both on the board of Cover Oregon and the Consumer Advisory Committee. We did a poll of our small businesses across the state, specifically in rural Oregon, this past summer. In a sampling of 350 of rural Oregon small businesses, 86% of them did not offer health insurance to their employees. 80% were not aware that Cover Oregon would be taking applications for small businesses starting in October. But 69% would like to know more about the opportunity to offer health insurance to their employees through the insurance exchange. So we've been active in encouraging and advocating and educating businesses all across the state about the exchange, about Cover Oregon, and pushing them as hard as possible to control costs for the exchange. Which has actually led us to the interest in today's bill. I sent out a quick email to our statewide leadership circle, which is about 60 active leaders who take on responsibility of advocating on behalf of themselves and businesses and communities across the state in preparation for this hearing. And I asked them if they would support this bill unanimously. They would, especially the Dash 2 amendments. And then we actually asked then to for them to list related, you know, issues that they were currently having or had with regard to their insurance providers in the past. Those who weren't arguing for eliminating insurance companies altogether and going to a single-payer system said these things, and I'll just read through these briefly. Frequent rate increases, reduction of benefits, denial of items covered by policy, and then having to go through appeals process, rate increases more than once a year, like we're seeing now, double digit rate increases. People saying that they pay three times as much for a policy with a $7,500 deductible, and their employees are paying $500 deductibles in 2006. Rate increases without service improvements, rate increases that outstrip the growth of their businesses. These go on and on and on. Main Street Alliance business, or Main Street businesses across Oregon, are not happy about insurance increases, obviously. And whatever we can do to strengthen the insurance rate review process, we are in support of. So we encourage you to vote for Senate Bill 413, specifically the Dash 2 amendments. And
are the Dash 2 amendments already in the bill?
No, they were introduced by the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection.
But not put into the bill?
But not put into the bill. But we're in support of those which introduce prior acknowledgement to rate increases.
So those are the Dash 7s, I believe, now.
Those are now called Dash 7s. Excuse me for the confusion.
And to clarify, it was the Dash 6 that is the cost containment strategy. I misspoke and said Dash 8. The Dash 6.
Great.
Mr. Chair?
Let's just go on with the testimony. We'll figure it out later.
Okay, we got A6, A7, Dash 5, Dash 2.
Well, I think all we have actually in front of us, all we intend to consider at the moment, is the 6, 7, and 8.
I don't have an 8.
Yeah, the 8's not.
You don't have the 8 yet. You don't have
the 8. Okay. Well, thank you for your time.
Yes, Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. In support of A. Engrost Senate Bill 413. This bill has had a lot of attention on the Senate side, and Senator Mona Sanderson did head up a work group, and we met on this bill, and we discussed most of these issues, and the A. Engrost bill is what is before you. And as she testified, our argument against some of the amendments was added costs, and the bill in its original form required an insurer within 3 days of a filing get this notice to everybody, which was a deadline we could not physically meet. And so we started from there, and we worked back to this final product. What this bill does do that really hasn't been discussed yet is it requires an insurer to every year annually, not based on the percentage increase of their filing, but annually, every year, notify each individual policyholder and certificate holder and small group, and the policyholder and small group, to notify them every year. I want to quote from the statute that the information be in a conspicuous it says including the information in a prominent manner in a mailing. And so what this allows...
My understanding is, after talking to at least one of the insurance company representatives, that the intention was to notify them at the time of renewal, which is months after the filing and the hearings on. Is that right? Would that be allowed under this bill?
It would. It would be allowed at the time of renewal. But if... we would have to do it each and every year. If somebody's angry about their rate, they could sign up for immediate notification from the insurance division from then on. So once you get on their website and your insurer makes a filing, you're immediately notified before the 30-day process. So this would allow an insurer, instead of doing a separate mailing each year, to do it with other mailings to those policyholders and certificate holders, not based on a specific date and a separate mailing, which costs a lot of money. And that's really where the argument was.
That's a dollar roughly per person, right?
It would probably be more than that. If you go to a standard website and ask the question, what does it cost to send out a business letter? It's more expensive than one would think, and particularly when you write a program for who, in an insurance sense, you have to write a program to extract the information from the policyholders to those who are insured individually under these products and those in small groups and not others. If you notify, it's a HIPAA requirement that we cannot send information to people about anyone else's insurance status. And so you have to be very careful with these mailings. They're not something you can just send a blanket mailing to. You have to know they are the person being insured, and you write a program to do that. So it's not as easy, and that's the problem we had with the original bill, was the timeline. Because your book of business is changing all the time, and people have different renewal dates as well. So it's not as if you can just push a button and these things come out. Regents is one of the largest printing operations in the state of Oregon. Just on the information they have to send out to people.
And all I would ask is, your premium is about $6,000 a year. Let's say it costs $5 to send out a bill, information in February, so everybody knows there's rates coming up. It seems to me $5 out of $6,000 is what? 0.1%.
Well, Mr. Chairman, everything we do is in increments of some dollar amount, and they add up to a lot of money.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I actually just pulled up the Oregon Insurance Division, their website, and went through, and it's actually pretty easy to walk through and get it and set it up to where you get email notifications for your thing. Just search for it.
The only question is whether you notify the insurers that they can do what you just did.
Yeah. Well, and I'll be kind of interested, because I know Osberg will be coming up and they received money or a grant for notifying consumers of this, so I'll be kind of curious to see what they've done with that money.
And Mr. Chairman, under this bill, annually they would get such a notice to sign up for that if they want, and the bill specifically says that's one of the things that the notice has to do, is to explain to them how to use the website and give instructions on how to get on the website.
Okay, are we done? Any other questions?
Next time I'll send the other John Powell.
No, I like this better. I like the original.
Okay, thanks.
That's John.
Jesse O'Brien.
Jesse, you're the last. Last but not least.
Just the man we need to see.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien, healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. So I'll try to keep this brief, because I did submit detailed written comment. We think that SB 413 represents an important opportunity to take the next steps to build on Oregon's very successful, transparent, open health insurance rate review program. We would urge you to consider the full package of amendments before you today in that light. We're here today specifically to talk about the Dash 6 and Dash 7 amendments. I also just wanted to put it on the record that we do not support the A and Gross version of the bill. We do not think it goes far enough to ensure that Oregon consumers and small businesses are informed about their ability to participate in the rate review process.
You don't support it in that. If we don't amend it, you would prefer we kill it?
We have no position on the A and Gross bill.
I thought you said you don't support
it. We do not support it, but we also do not oppose it.
Gotcha.
So I'll start with the Dash 7 amendments, which relate directly back to the original purpose of the bill, which was to provide greater notice to policyholders of impending rate increases. The Dash 7 amendments were based off of our attempt to acknowledge the technical concerns about the prior notification that the carriers raised when this bill was first brought up on the Senate side. We believe that the different provisions of this amendment get around the HIPAA concerns and will still provide greatly expanded notice to policyholders at pretty minimal cost. So the way the Dash 7 amendments work is, first of all, it would enable consumers to sign up to receive email notification through DCBS, through their existing email notification system, when they enroll or renew a policy. So basically the way this would work is that on an enrollment or renewal form, there would be a simple box that a policyholder could check saying, I want to sign up for notification through DCBS, and then the insurer would give that information to the department. And then secondly, the Dash 7 amendments would require insurers to send an annual notice to policyholders explaining how they can participate in the process. This notice could be generic. It would not have to have identifying information on it, and so therefore it would not be subject to the HIPAA requirements that were raised earlier. And then finally, it would require information about the process and how you can participate in a range of other communications with policyholders, just to make sure that the information is out there as widely as possible. We think that this is actually a good compromise with the concerns that the carriers raised on the Senate side, and would really it would help provide policyholders, but especially small employers, with important information. Small employers really need to know about trends and costs for health insurance so they can plan for the future. On the Senate side, we were able to have a small business person come in and testify about how this would help her business. She was unavailable today, unfortunately. So the Dash 7 amendments would be a small step and an important step to build on the success of the process so far. And then just very briefly, we also support the Dash 6 amendments. The Dash 6 amendments are really taking the next step at making health insurance rate review more effective here in Oregon. The health insurance rate review process has been very effective in really scrutinizing the justification of rate increases, making sure the math adds up, and scrutinizing closely carrier administrative costs, but it has yet to be very effective at scrutinizing cost containment, which is supposed to be part of the process. Ms. Higgins referred to this earlier, so I won't go into great depth here, but the Dash 6 amendments would just direct DCBS and the Health Authority to come together to create a set of metrics and standards that could make this much more robust part of the process. So we do think that since studies consistently show that about a third or even more of spending in the healthcare delivery system is wasted on things that do not improve health, rate review really does have a role to play here to make sure that policyholders are being protected from these unnecessary excessive costs, and there's a lot more that we could do in this area. And the Dash 6 amendments would really be taking the first step in that direction. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Yes, briefly.
Okay, thank you. Just so for clarification, in terms of the customer client notification, I imagine that you didn't go to an opt-out system of just saying let us know if you don't want us to give your email address to DCBS because of privacy concerns or concerns they may not open the envelope. And yet you are also saying that you think it's too onerous for them to go on their own. The regents had testified that, you know, they will give information once a year and people can go on their own, here are directions. So you're picking a middle road, which is an opt-in. So just to so I understand that, to clarify that, somebody would check a box and send the mail back to their insurance carrier to allow their email address to get transferred to DCBS?
Right. It would be included in a standard enrollment or renewal form.
So they have to be sending the mail back anyway?
Right.
It's not added expense for the customer?
That aspect of it would not be an added expense.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
Okay. Aside from whatever expense would be required to change the forms.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Actually, could I just ask one question?
We've got 32 minutes on one bill. We have seven more to do, so there's no hurry.
Okay. Well, no hurry. Well, just real quick, there's money, a $5 million federal grant that you'd receive to actually inform people. I'm just wondering, have you used anything or done anything with your website to drive them to the Oregon Insurance Exchange? Because I'm kind of looking at their site. Looks to me like we need to get people to it because it's one, everybody knows it, and it would make sense. And I don't know if you have links on your website or if you guys have been pushing that information.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Widener, that's a great question. Osprey Foundation, our C3 sister organization, does have a grant that's administered by the Department of Consumer and Business Services to act as a consumer voice in the rate review process. Since we're in the interest of time, I won't go into great detail about how that works, but we do definitely try to get the word out as part of our involvement in the rate review process. We alert our members. We try to alert the affected members of the public as much as possible, and we try to bring the attention of policymakers and the public at large through media outreach and a wide range of activities. But we're not a huge organization, and we can't guarantee that we can get the word to everybody who's affected by every major rating.
Send us a message on this, since it's not directly germane to this bill. I appreciate it if you just
absolutely
give us an update of what you do. Thank you.
Thanks.
We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 413A. We won't open up a work session, but we will reschedule it for next Monday. So please, if you have a chance before then, check the dash 6, 7, and 8 amendment. We'll have 8 on by the end of this afternoon. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 136. Will you remind us what that's about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 136A authorizes the Oregon State Board of Nursing to allow certified registered nurse anesthetists to prescribe drugs. It authorizes the Board of Nursing to determine scope of allowance and assess fees as necessary. It allows the Board of Nursing to determine procedure and grounds for emergency license suspension. Establishes pharmacotherapeutics education requirements. It specifies certified registered nurse anesthetists may prescribe for no more than a 10-day supply with no refills and prescribe only for an established client or patient.
Can we have an amendment, a motion on that, please?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 136A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 136A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Clem?
Excuse.
Representative Conger?
Excuse.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion carries. Senate Bill 136A is on the way to the floor. Somebody would like to carry that? Yeah. Representative Lively, you got it. Still no other senators here yet. Okay. Let's do a public hearing on Senate Bill 777. You want to tell us what that's about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 777A modifies meeting requirements of the Oregon Health Authority's Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. It requires the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee to divide agenda into two separate sections. It specifies required committee findings shall be by majority vote and deletes undefined term other reimbursements and declares emergency effective on its passage.
Would you call some witnesses, please?
Ann Murray and Tom Burns.
Burns, that's what that said, huh? Ms. Murray, nice to see you again.
So you too, Mr. Chair.
I could even say the same thing about the guy sitting next to
me. Oh, should I say I can too? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Murray with Bristol Myers Squibb. And Senate Bill 777A before you today actually proposes a few modifications to legislation that the chair and vice chair are very familiar with from 2011, and that was the OHA's bill that would actually create the Health Evidence Review Commission and the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, establish those two committees. We had a work group that probably met for
months.
A long time. work out the nuances of that legislation. And after more than a year of operating under that new structure, this bill before you proposes some modifications to the manner in which the P&T committee operates. It does not propose any changes whatsoever to the overall function of the P&T committee, but rather proposes some changes to enhance transparency and provide a better ability for folks to be noticed and involved in the P&T committee process. Specifically, the bill does, in my estimation, six different things. I can go through and give you a highlight of those six, if you prefer.
As fast as you can.
The bill would require the name of any drug that's being considered by the P&T committee to show up on the agenda so that folks actually know the specific drugs that are going to be reviewed. It requires the documents that are going to be considered by the committee to be posted on the committee's website. Under current law, background materials and supporting documentation are required to be posted on the website. We've run into a couple situations where there have been other documents that were being considered by the committee that were deemed to not be background materials, so they were not provided publicly. And so Senate Bill 777 adds to the documents that are to be posted, any other documents to be considered by the committee, subject to, obviously, any confidential documentation that might be reviewed in executive session that's just not publicly disclosable. It does require that the agenda be divided into two separate sections, one for the drug use review function of the P&T committee, and specifically that relates to the committee's responsibility and duty to ensure minimization of things like drug-drug interactions, contraindications, to advise on correct dosing, duration of treatment, drug abuse, misuse. That's the DUR function. And a separate function being the pharmacy and therapeutics function, which actually is the process by which the committee makes recommendations to the Oregon Health Authority about what drugs are specifically preferred and non-preferred covered under the Oregon Health Plan. So what the bill does is require that the agenda for the committee be divided into those two separate sections so folks at the meeting will know what's going on at a given time. Currently, the committee is permitted to meet in executive session for very specific purposes in statute, and the bill before you would require the agenda to simply to list the purpose for that meeting in executive session. One of those permissible purposes is to consider drug costs in instances where the committee has determined that the drugs in the same therapeutic class are comparable in safety and efficacy. They can then look at cost to make a determination about what would be preferred under the Oregon Health Plan list. Senate Bill 777 doesn't change that, but would require that the committee findings would be established in advance of executive session that said that the deciding factor with regard to what drug would be preferred, if in fact it was going to be based on cost, that there be committee findings prior to going into executive session that state just that, that all of the things being equal, cost will be the deciding factor in this particular case. And then finally, the bill would require committee findings to accompany the recommendations and add the requirement that the P&T committee consider the actual FDA-approved indications of a drug in its determinations with regard to coverage and preference. We always thought that kind of went without saying, but we're choosing to say it now, that in fact the committee will consider the actual FDA-approved indications in making the determinations. With that, Mr. Chair, the bill came out of the Senate 423 unanimously. We did work on amendments with the department over the course of about a month in the Senate, and I understand from my asking Mr. Burns about 5 minutes before the hearing began that they may have concerns with the bill now, and I am happy to address them with Mr. Burns before you today. Thank you.
Mr. Burns.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. The function of the P&T committee, I guess, lives under me. It's something that I have been working on with many people for a long time to make this a functioning process. And as Ann points out, we spent a lot of time creating the bill, and then we've had about 15 months now of implementing the provisions of it. I think Ann has some valid points about some concerns that she's addressed. I would, however, say that as with any organization that starts up, there's some learning that you have to go on. There have been instances where the issues that Ann has raised has, in fact, actually occurred. I do not deny that. But when they were brought to the attention, the committee has modified its processes. And, in fact, I would be hard-pressed to find any of these that we are not currently functioning under. If I can go through and point out some of the concerns, I don't want to use the word concerns because, frankly, we don't think the bill does anything that we're not currently doing. So it's not a concern. It just becomes a question of, is it worth passing a piece of legislation to do this and adding words to the code that is already being done. The first one is the purpose of listing the drugs. We list the drug that is being considered and associated with that the class of drugs that that drug is in. Some classes, and I just randomly picked one, maybe the largest one, I don't know, but last month we considered the steroid class. There were 146 drugs in that class, and that is something that is common knowledge if you are in the industry, requiring us to list all 146 drugs on a website or on an agenda would become a paperwork nightmare for us. If we missed one drug, what's the consequences? Does the whole process have to start over again because we missed one drug because of a clerical error? I'm not quite sure what that accomplishes and what it does when you can find the class of drugs, and from the class of drugs will lead you to all the drugs that are out there through any common drug source. The addition of any other documents to be considered by the committee, we publish every document that the committee gets in advance. We publish a draft 60 days in advance. We ask for comments on that draft. That draft is then changed and modified and becomes a permanent document and is sent to the committee 30 days in advance of the committee. I do not know of any case where there was other documents considered by the committee that was a surprise. If there were, shame on us. There may have been a case at the very beginning where that occurred, but today I'm absolutely adamant there are no surprises. We will not allow any new documentation to be added to the sent to the committee by the staff or by OHA once we post them live 30 days in advance. Dividing the agenda into two separate parts, you can pull the agenda. We have a hearing on May 30th, and you can pull the agenda off our webpage. The first one is call to order. The second agenda item is DUR activities. And the third agenda item is new business, which is where we make P&T decisions. I don't know how to be more specific than what we are already currently doing. Going into executive session, there are four reasons why the committee goes into executive session. Reviewing the prescribing or dispensing practices of individual physicians. Well, I can't very well say we're going to look at a physician I guess I could say we are going to go look at a physician, but I can't name the physician. I can't identify the physician. The same thing holds for prescribing, reviewing data for individual physicians or pharmacists, reviewing profiles of individual patients. Those are the three item actions that we can go into the P&T committee, plus the one that Ann references, and that's the ability to do confidential pricing. Those are what we do. We could say, put on the agenda each time. We're going into all four of these, but there are three of them that we simply are not a public document and not something that we can announce in advance. Findings in advance of going into the executive session. We have a hearing, we have a discussion, we have public input, the committee talks about it, and short of saying, I move that all these drugs are the same, it's pretty obvious from the discussion that the reason why we're going into the executive session is because there is a cost issue involved. We could have a vote beforehand, go into executive session, come back to executive session with the report, and have a second vote. But I'm not sure what that does for the public or what it does for the proponents or what it does other than put an additional burden to the committee. And then the idea of including the use of drugs that are approved by the Food and Drug Administration. We wouldn't be considering the drug if the drug hadn't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. My concern with this language is that there are times when there are appropriate compendia and appropriate historical knowledge out there where we do, in fact, approve a drug for an off-label use. Mm-hmm. And that occurs because the drug has, over time, been discovered to serve an off-label use. That is not a use that has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, and I would be very concerned if this language stayed in that would potentially tie our hands to the ability to approve a drug for off-label use. Again, can we live with this bill? Absolutely. Is it worth putting in the code? It's your call.
Other questions of either witness?
Yes, Jim. Just a comment, both of you. We've been doing this for, seems like half my lifetime. And originally, he got into this because there were a number of things not being done, generally under the guideline, I think, of transparency. My question is, I understand what you're saying, Tom, but if we don't put this in statute, the next time we have this discussion, you, Ann, or I might not be here. And there, I would argue to put it in statute because it gives us guidance on what the expectations for the process are. Now, if some of these are not quite right, then we need to amend them. I would certainly have that discussion. But favoring transparency in government affairs, I come down on the side of I think we do need to put this in statute so that we have something, if for no other reason, we come back in another year and change because it didn't work. But it gives us some really solid guidelines for what we intended to happen in this realm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, Ann likes to say that she trusts me implicitly, but she doesn't trust my replacement. And I understand her point, and it's very well taken. That's your call.
Let me suggest this. If you two would get together and make sure the words are clarified, and if you have an amendment in case we decide to move the bill, if there's something that you can agree on, I mean, like the FDA question, for example, or that would be very helpful. Let us know as soon as possible. You're right. It'll be our decision whether we should go forward or not. It doesn't sound like Western civilization will come to an end if we do go forward. But if you would have a chance to consult and then get back to us, say by the end of the week, that would be very helpful. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, certainly. I think Mr. Burns didn't quite accurately characterize what the bill's requiring of the department, though, in two or three different situations, and specifically with regard to the FDA issue and, of course, with regard to the notice of executive session. So I'd be more than happy to clarify for those both the record now or at a time that...
No, you don't need to clarify. You can just work on something. If you can get something else for us to look at, if not, we'll go along with what we hear in the decisions, okay?
Thank you.
I will. Take it on the record that you didn't exactly agree with everything he said.
with the mischaracterizations. You're right. Thank you.
I've been in that situation myself, so it doesn't surprise me. I will close the public hearing.
With you?
On...
Bates.
Pardon me?
Did you see Senator Bates?
Yeah, no. Okay, I close the public hearing for?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing as soon as I can find it. On Senate Bill 777, and we won't carry it over, but we'll reschedule it maybe for Monday of next week.
Okay.
Decide at that point. Thank you. Okay. Where are we going? Who else do we have out there? On 375? Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 375. And ask Senator Bates to join us. Are you going to testify on another bill as well, Senator?
I think just 375 today.
Okay.
I don't know if you have up, so...
Go for it.
You do, it'd be a little surprise for me. That's what I was just...
We have a selection here if you'd like to pick one.
Yeah, several of them are yours, actually.
Bill, we wasn't mean.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alan Bates, a state senator from Southern Oregon. For disclosure, I'm also a family physician and, as you might guess, have an interest in healthcare issues. What I'd like to do in my testimony today is kind of lay out for you why this bill is in front of you and then let others come up and actually talk about the bill itself. I think that's a better way of handling it. This bill is the result of a consensus that was reached over a period of almost a year and a half, all parties involved, hospitals, physicians, and others. Many meetings in Portland. Drove up, but did not walk up for those meetings. They were long and at times contentious, but at the end we've got a consensus bill in front of you that really works. I'm going to give you a little primer on emergency rooms just very quickly if you would allow me to. There are three major areas where people come into the emergency room basically in a life and death situation in which time is of an essence. Those are in trauma, those are in heart attacks, and those frankly are in strokes. You could also include some hypoglycemic episodes, but they're fairly rare. So the big three are those three. You'll be seeing or have seen a trauma bill, and we will someday bring to you something on heart attacks called STEMI. We won't be doing that today. This is, of course, the stroke bill. Oregon suffers from an excessive number of strokes per population compared to the rest of the United States. We're not quite certain why that is, but it is a fact. We also have some of the worst outcomes for a stroke, despite our best efforts at this point. There has been a tremendous stroke network set up outside of any effect by the legislature. Most of the major hospitals have telemedicine, in which a ER physician can immediately access a neurologist to look at the patient, talk about the patient, and determine what kind of stroke is occurring. There are basically two types of stroke. One's called an ischemic stroke, one's a hemorrhagic stroke, and they're treated completely differently. And this is kind of where we get into this. Most strokes are ischemic. A little clot is formed, flow to the brain, and as the minutes tick by, when that artery in the brain is blocked, more and more brain cells are dying. If you can get in there and dissolve that clot quickly, you can save a lot of the brain, if not all the brain, and people can recover. If it's a hemorrhagic stroke, and you do something to that brain that would allow it to bleed more, you can kill the patient. So what you're looking at here is a way of saying which patients should receive something that breaks up a clot, that anticoagulates the blood, and which patients should not. So you've got to screen those patients usually with a CT scanner and then go ahead and inject medications that start breaking that clot up. I believe one of the major problems we have in this state is that physicians in emergency rooms are fearful of giving them the medication that breaks clots up because you're always risking a bleed in that brain and the sudden death of the patient. The system's been set up actually helps physicians make that very tough decision and gives them some protection when they make that decision. What this bill specifically does is starts looking at the system we presently have. What kind of outcomes are we seeing? How can we improve those outcomes? And the way you do this in trauma and the way we've done it in heart attack is by looking at the data getting a chance to bring all that data in from all those hospitals, seeing how many cases you have, looking at the outcomes in those cases, and then when you see areas where is not being the outcomes you want are not occurring, then you can take those best practices down to those areas and say, are you doing this? Are you doing that? Are you doing this? That kind of information sharing is the key to what we're doing here. And once that starts to occur, I think physicians will feel more comfortable with what they need to do. They'll feel as if they're making the right decisions. And in the end, the most important thing will happen, which is there'll be better outcomes for patients with strokes in this state. We'll never stop strokes entirely, but we can make them a lot less devastating for a patient with a better outcome after they've had that stroke. So that's the basis of what we're doing with this. Others will talk to you about the bill itself, but I wanted to lay the ground for how we got about putting the bill together and what we're trying to achieve with the bill. I'm glad to take any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
You guys are pretty easy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have, I think, three. Is that right?
Two more.
Would you please call?
Stephanie Tamas-Sweet and Dr. Mel Cohn. And Patty O'Sullivan.
I think you got five votes. Don't try and go for four.
I go first. Yeah. Chair Greenlich and members of the committee.
Briefly, please.
Okay. My name is Stephanie Tamas-Sweet, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association, which is also the American Stroke Association. The American Stroke Association is a division of the Heart Association, and we are dedicated to improving stroke prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. And we strongly support the bill before you, Senate Bill 375A. And Senator Bates did a really good job of giving the background on the bill and why we're here today. I've had the privilege of working with both people to my right and my left and many others, physicians, folks from the hospital, community, advocates, stroke providers, stroke survivors, really looking at stroke in the state and what can we do to take Oregon a step forward to having better care, better data, and essentially better outcomes for stroke patients. And so this bill takes us one step forward. It's a really important step for the state of Oregon, and we're strongly supportive of the bill. Like Senator Bates said, this is a consensus bill, so did our best to really work out a lot of the kinks and difficulties and challenges and differences before we got to this space, and are really glad that we're able to come together as a front and support it today. So I won't go into a lot of details because Senator Bates did a great job talking about what a stroke is and the differences for stroke. Just so you have a little bit of the stats, and I think Dr. Cohn will be speaking to this as well. Stroke is the fourth leading cause of death in Oregon, and it's the number one cause of preventable disability in our state. May happens to be Stroke Month, and so there's a lot of talk about this out there in the press. Hopefully you've seen some survivors and advocates talking about stroke. That's just kind of a side note that I wanted to throw in. In 2011, nearly 2,000 Oregonians died from stroke, and there were nearly 8,000 stroke hospitalizations in 2011. So stroke takes a big toll on our communities, and it takes a big toll also on the families and friends and loved ones of those stroke survivors who often do have long-term disabilities. And so the families and friends of those members are very connected to stroke and want to know what they can do to better care for their loved ones. This bill does two really quick things. It sets up a committee that would advise the state on improving systems and care for stroke patients, and it asks the Oregon Health Authority to designate a database for improving quality systems of care. Again, really careful on trying to articulate how we do this and making sure that the parties involved are comfortable. We feel very strongly that we need to get better data in order to make better improvements to the system, and feel like this bill will help us get there. So that is all of my statements today. Happy to respond to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We are in full support of this bill. It was a grueling process. One of the statistics that Stephanie mentioned was in 2007 how many deaths there were from strokes, and my mom was one of those. And so this is something that I've worked on really hard for the association, but also sort of had a little bit of me in it as well. There's right now three kinds of hospitals. We have a brand new, what's called a comprehensive stroke hospital. OHSU just got their recognition as that, and Providence is very close. The rest of the next level down are primary, and then the ones that don't have either of those designations are just regular hospitals, and they do something, I'd love to say this during testimony, they do something called drip and ship. So they give them the TPA, and they send them to one of the either primary or comprehensive. So again, everybody's giving you all the details. I will cut it short and answer any questions that you would like. Thank you.
Dr. Cohn.
Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, and Thompson, thank you very much for hearing this bill this afternoon. I don't have too much to add except to say that I want to acknowledge Senator Bates' leadership in bringing this whole effort together. I do think this is a step forward to do quality improvement around the care of people who experience strokes. Of course, in public health, we would prefer to prevent the strokes from occurring in the first place. That's something that we also need to do, but it's also very, very important that people get rapid care and high quality care for this very, very serious problem. The price tag for this in Oregon is upwards of $250 million a year. Excuse me. And so I think we can save a lot of money and a lot of pain and suffering as well if we do a better job taking care of people. So that I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on where are we? On Senate Bill 375 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 375. Mm. We have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 375 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves Senate Bill 375A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? See how easy that was? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Lightley?
Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion passes. Incidentally, we did have a proposed amendment that we were going to use this as a vehicle for, but we found an actual better bill to use the vehicle. So if any of you had heard about that and are wondering about it, it's going to be on something else. Who would like to carry this?
I can.
Who?
Do you want to carry
it? I just couldn't.
I got a heart problem.
Yeah.
I should carry it.
My neighbor had a stroke recently.
Clem, you get to carry it.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. Thank you.
My father had a stroke.
See, the reward for coming.
So does my mother-in-law.
You can co-carry.
She's not dead, actually.
High blood pressure.
Do you want to co-carry?
And my aunt.
Somebody want to co-carry? One's enough. This is... Okay, I close the work session on 375. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 22A. So, Senator Hayward, go for it. And briefly.
Very briefly.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Thompson, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17. Proud to share that Becker. District with both.
All right, Becker, we'll be with you in a minute. Don't go away.
Thank you.
This is your favorite adjunct professor.
Anyway, in my other life, I'm a family physician, also up at OHSU, along with Dr. Becker, from whom you'll be hearing shortly. And Senator Girard and I brought this bill forward because we think that the health authority and the state need to play an increasing role in educating people about human papillomaviruses and the ways that we can both reduce transmission and reduce infection with these scary viruses. I say scary because many of them are known to trigger, be necessary, in fact, for the development of certain kinds of cancer. And while the one that's been the most prominent in the news is cervical cancer, one of the reasons Senator Girard is very interested in this is because they also cause oral and pharyngeal cancers, cancers of the mouth and throat. As you probably know, Senator Girard is a dentist. So with the availability now of vaccines, which Dr. Becker was instrumental in helping to develop, and you'll hear about those more from him, and the fact that the CDC has recently recommended that not only girls but also boys be immunized against HPV to help prevent transmission and acquiring these serious viruses, we thought it was a good time to have OHA get involved with educating the public further about these viruses, about the kinds of things that they can cause, and about the availability of a vaccine that insurance companies do cover, that is covered under OMAP, that is widely available and very safe. So we've just asked that this be part of OHA's things. OHA is supportive of this idea. This passed solidly over on the Senate side of the building, and I will end there and be happy to take questions or wait for Dr. Becker.
Thank you. Let's wait for Dr. Becker. Tom, you
Chair
got
Greenlight
it.
And Vice Chairs Kenny Geyer and Thompson and members of the committee, thanks very much for the opportunity to testify before you on Senate Bill 722. I'm a physician epidemiologist based at OHSU School of Medicine. I'm chair of the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, following in the steps of Chairman Greenlich, and have a long history of research related to HPV infections. So we heard a little bit of introduction about papillomavirus infections and their importance in human health. I guess I could set the stage by saying that there are over 100 different... I'm sorry?
Not for most, Tom.
There are over 100 different HPV types that are associated with a variety of human diseases, including cervical cancer and pre-invasive lesions of the cervix. In addition, vaginal, vulvar, and penile cancers. As just mentioned, oropharyngeal cancers. There is a rare condition called respiratory papillomatosis, where a wart-like growths grow on the vocal cords, and they obstruct the airway, leading to basically suffocation. In addition, skin warts are caused by papillomavirus, as well as genital warts, which can be a major management problem for clinicians for their patients who can have very common wart infections of the external genitalia. So from a public health perspective, the genital infections and oropharyngeal cancers appear to be of greatest public health significance. From the standpoint of sexually transmitted infections or sexually transmitted diseases, papillomavirus is one of the most common of all the STDs or STIs in this country and quite possibly in all countries. Now, from the standpoint of a program on HPV education, in my view, there appears to be a substantial misconception about genital HPV in particular, its transmission, the natural history, the treatment, and also methods for prevention of infection, including vaccine. So even clinicians don't seem to have accurate and up-to-date information to give their patients, and those patients can be misinformed about options for HPV prevention and options for treatment. Now, one of the key concepts that the committee might want to be aware of is, you know that there are two different HPV vaccines that have been approved by FDA, one by Merck and the other by Glaxo Corporation. And these HPV types in the two vaccines protect against the most common HPV types that cause invasive cervical cancer. However, there's a whole boatload of HPV types that cause pre-invasive cervical lesions, in other words, abnormal pap smears. And these lesions get far enough along that they require treatment, sometimes very aggressive therapy, which can be expensive and also very inconvenient for the patients. Some of the pre-invasive lesions may require a surgical procedure known as a cold knife conization, and there are sequelae for those patients who wish to carry children or fetuses to term after that, that cervical incompetence can be resolved.
Tom, are these things going to be on the final?
This will be on the final exam. I'll send it to you, and I expect the answers back for tomorrow.
Dr. Becker,
so I don't think patients are all getting the right messages about papilloma, so I'm very supportive of an education program that would get accurate information out to Oregonians about a vaccine and what it can and can't do, about risk for certain sexual practices, and also information about treatment in addition to prevention. So this seems like a very good plan to me.
Good. Are there any questions? And be careful. We got some more information. Tom, thank you very much for taking the time.
I think certainly feel welcome to call back if questions do arise. I'm at your service.
I think we're just going to move it forward, so that's the easy way.
Thanks, Tom.
Great. Thank you all. Bye.
Bye. Are there any questions of Senator Steiner? Or I can make it. I actually did some of the basic work that tied HPV to cancer back in the 70s. It's important. Okay.
I can ask her later.
Okay. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 722 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 222A. Do I have a...
722A.
I'm sorry, 722A. All right.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 722A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves Senate Bill 722A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kammer?
Aye.
Representative Lightley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion carries. Senate Bill 722A is on its way to the floor with Representative Kenny Geyer carrying it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 722A. I'm going to, we have one witness for Senate Bill 569A, and we're gonna be considering an amendment. We're not ready to move with the amendment, so after the public hearing, we'll move it over to Friday and get it finished Friday. Right?
Okay. Works with me. You want to have the hearing today?
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 569A and call Mark Longgren, please.
I think I'm going to do some introduction of this.
If you do it quickly. But, I mean, if not, I can wait till Friday with you.
All right, we'll wait till Friday.
You want to talk about the amendment, right?
I can talk about the amendment later. We'll let it go.
We'll
hear from you today, and we'll take up the rest later.
Okay. I think you've been shut down.
It's okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlink and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Lovegren. I'm the director of the telehealth services at Oregon Health and Science University. First, I'd like to thank Representative Harker for his leadership along with Senator Steiner Hayward to help break down some of the barriers to expanding telemedicine services in Oregon. Oregon Health and Science University strongly supports Senate Bill 569A with the -86 amendments in order to provide standardization of telemedicine credentialing requirements for hospitals in Oregon. In a matter of a few years, telemedicine has made it possible for OHSU stroke neurologists, pediatric and neonatal intensive care physicians, genetic specialists, psychiatrists, and other medical experts to treat patients almost anywhere in the state. In fact, the OHSU telemedicine network has expanded its offerings, allowing patients in over a dozen communities to have access to our services minutes after they arrive in their local emergency room or nursery. Since May 2010 alone, our telemedicine specialists have performed nearly 450 acute care consults, assisting local physicians with treatment and transfer decisions. This ranges from reassuring the local team about the appropriateness of their treatment plan to helping resuscitate newborns. Not only has this saved lives, OHSU's telemedicine has allowed over a third of our patients to remain in their home community for medical care and saved nearly $2.5 million in transport costs alone. If we were to look at the savings provided by all telemedicine programs across the state, that number would likely be exponentially higher. However, a 20th century regulatory system still hampers our ability to deliver 21st century care where it's most urgently needed. Most onerous is the federal requirement for each physician providing telemedicine to be credentialed at each hospital where services are provided. Credentialing can mean each of our physicians and our credentialing team has to compile dozens of pages of documentation for every hospital where they provide telemedicine consultations. Because individual hospitals often have different requirements, new credentialing packets have to be created each time a new physician or specialty is added. Multiply this requirement by Oregon's 58 hospitals, and the bureaucratic challenge becomes staggering. Despite movement at the federal level to modernize some of these requirements, this remains our greatest roadblock to expanding access to medical care through telemedicine. Senate Bill 569 seeks to standardize these requirements in order to provide some stability in the credentialing application process for telemedicine providers and hospitals throughout the state. As a hospital administrator, I fully understand and respect the needs of a hospital's governing body to credential their medical staff in order to determine if a healthcare provider is eligible to receive privileges at their facility, both for those providers that serve patients in person and those that serve patients via telepresence.
Mike, it turns out we do have the paperwork to pass this, so if you'll speed it up, we'll have time, and we'll actually get it out of here.
Well, on that note, thank you very much.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
He's also smart.
And Representative, if you could be very brief about the amendment we have.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. Committee members, I am Chris Harker, House District 34, which is Beaverton and unincorporated Washington County. I sit over there often. Consensus bill, as described, we have some dash six amendments that were promised before the bill passed unanimously out of the Senate, and they address a small fix, and they are primarily to a technical fix, which has the buy-in from the stakeholders, clarifying that the requirements apply only to telemedicine services provided between two hospitals. They'll help increase access to telemedicine services throughout the state by providing stability and standardization to the telemedicine credentialing process. The standardized lists that are going to be developed will importantly include the ability to reasonably request follow-up information or documents if there's a red flag or a problem of concern with the original documents that are provided. With those dash six amendments, I believe all concerns have been addressed.
Works that way to you too?
Yes.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 569A. I mean Senate Bill 569A. And open a work session at Senate Bill 569A.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash six amendments dated 5-10-13.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves to adopt the dash six amendments dated 5-10, was that?
5-10-13.
Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? The amendments are in 5-6-9. Yes, sir.
I have someone say 5-15-13 is what it says online.
We will take the dash six amendments, whatever date they're dated.
Did you open it? Sometimes it gets posted on 5-15, but the amendment is dated 5-10.
Okay. Let's go. Next motion.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 569A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves Senate Bill 569A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative
Walker? Aye.
Representative
Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer? Aye.
Representative
Wiley? Aye.
Representative Wagner?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kennedy
Dyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kinnemer? Aye. Motion carries. Senate Bill 569A, as amended with the dash six amendment, moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Harker? You got it.
Sign you up.
Representative Harker will carry it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 569A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 281. Will you tell us what this bill is about?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 281 adds post-traumatic stress disorder to the definition of debilitating medical condition for the purposes of authorizing medical use of marijuana.
Two calls on here. We have about 20 minutes to do this. I'm going to ask you to all keep your testimony to 2 minutes, and we'll get everybody in. And Representative Olson, I see you back there. Why don't we start with these two gentlemen and then Representative Olson in the first panel? Come on.
I anticipated having the witnesses were testifying by phone, testify after the first panel.
After the first panel?
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's start with the two of you, and then is Representative Olson still here?
We have a third person for the first panel as well.
I'd like to hear Representative Olson if he's here. Apparently not. Okay, bring your third person up. 2 minutes. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Chair, committee.
I am just wrapping up with the patient. Can I call you back in about 1 minute?
No, we'll call you back in about 5 minutes. Please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Todd Delato. I serve as chair of the Oregon Health Authority's Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, which unanimously supports the addition of PTSD to the list of qualifying conditions for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. I'm also a horticultural scientist and public policy consultant specializing in medicinal cannabis. I'm a constituent of Senator Boquist, who sponsored this bill on my behalf. And we're trying to be brief here, but I do encourage the committee to, if you have any doubts about this bill, to look at the to listen to the audio testimony from February 7th Senate Healthcare Committee hearing. There's a wealth of information from some of the nation's top medical experts and some compelling testimony from PTSD sufferers as well. I'm going to explain why we're doing this by statute. The Oregon Health Authority is charged to adopt rules for evaluating petitions for particular diseases or conditions to be included among those that qualify as debilitating medical conditions under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. The rules that were promulgated involved convening an expert panel to review the petition and make recommendations to the department regarding approval and denial. Unfortunately, these rules have proven to be inadequate for ensuring a fair review and decision-making process because of a lack of protection for bias, prejudice, and conflict of interest, and the lack of a requirement for the decision to be based upon objective scientific evidence. These serious flaws amount to a review process that fails to ensure petitions to add debilitating medical conditions will be reviewed fairly. This was manifested on two occasions in 2000 and 2009, which Mr. Berger will follow up with and give you details about how that went down.
I'll give you a couple more minutes because you're the lead off, but everybody else, I'm going to cut the 2 minutes.
Sure. And in June 2012, the Public Health Division was finally convinced that these flaws necessitated an overhaul of the review process. Thus, a Rules Advisory Committee was convened, which I was appointed to. To recommend changes to the administrative rules with the goals of establishing protections against bias, prejudice, conflict of interest, which was not met, to enhance accountability and transparency, which was partially met, establishing clear criteria for decision making, establishing a fair selection criteria of experts, and to streamline the process for greater efficiency. The Oregon Health Authority's Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana voted unanimously to support these goals, as well as the Rules Advisory Committee and most people who testified during the public comment period. In the finalized text, unfortunately, only one goal was fully met, and that was streamlining efficiency. Some of them were partially met, but the most important goal, to establish protections against bias, prejudice, and conflict of interest, was not met. And because this new rule will not ensure the objective review of future petitions to add debilitating medical conditions, and due to the bias that existed in the prior two petition processes, patients who suffer from PTSD and other debilitating conditions are still unable to rely upon the administrative process to consider their condition fairly. Therefore, the addition of debilitating conditions by statute is the only remaining way way to ensure people suffering from medical conditions that are safely and effectively treated with medicinal cannabis can be protected for their use of medicinal cannabis. I'm going to speak briefly to the Dash 5 amendments that Representative Olson will be presenting. I oppose those amendments as much as I support an intelligent approaches to cannabis policy reform. I don't feel it's appropriate to add that to this bill for a number of reasons. And largely because...
Wrap up, please.
Sure. And anyway, so I'm just urging you to please support 281 with a due pass recommendation without amendments so that Oregon can become a place where returning combat veterans and others suffering from serious trauma can feel more safe and protected here at home in Oregon. Thank you. I'm here happy to be available for questions.
Thank you. Who's next?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I've been practicing for 30 years. I represent patients and their providers statewide. I live and work in Representative Frederick and Senator Shields' district. The Medical Marijuana Act includes a provision, as Mr. Delato's testified to, where conditions can be added administratively. And if I were a legislator, I'd want to know how come this is in front of the legislature. And that's what I want to tell you about, is how we exhausted our remedies. And I'll talk as quickly as I possibly can, but it's a long and tortured story.
Tortured story, and you can talk all you want, but we're going to quit this hearing at a quarter to.
I understand.
So
I'm talking.
Anytime you take, and a long and tortured story is going to take away somebody.
I understand. I'll talk quickly. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Chair Greenlick, the bill passed in, the people passed the OMA in 1998. The first cards were issued in May of 99. In early 99, the Rules Advisory Committee created rules for adding new conditions. 1999, 2000, about 20 petitions were filed, including petitions for PTSD. Consolidated so-called hearings, which were held in private with secret evidence, held with unanimous agreement to add anxiety. The Department of Human Services instead added adult Alzheimer's, which ultimately, after Speaker Minnis was voted out of office, was codified. On March 28, 2005, a registered nurse who worked as a psychiatric nurse named Ed Glick filed a petition to convene the advisory panel for the purpose of considering the inclusion of several conditions. He, based on a study he had done at a place called the Compassion Center in Eugene, Dr. Grant Higginson on December 13, 2005 summarily denied it. The petition, the cause and pretense was that it was frivolous. Nurse Glick filed a petition in the Benton County Circuit Court where he lives, and Dr. Higginson offered to rescind the summary denial. Nurse Glick rejected this proposal because of how unfair DHS's procedures were in 2000. I met with Leonie Reeves, who is an assistant attorney general, now the governor's counsel, and we discussed a more fair procedure on January 26, 2009. At Nurse Glick's behalf, I filed a renewed petition to add six psychiatric conditions, including PTSD. Public hearings were held on 3 days in July and August of 2009, based on the rules that we had come up with. The panel was unfair. The way that Dr. Higginson structured it is he would appoint three marijuana prohibitionists and three people with knowledge of cannabis therapeutics, and so he ultimately would make the decision because the panel would split inevitably, which they did. And his recommendation was that the OMMP consider initiating a legislative concept for the 2011 session to allow research on medical marijuana for PTSD, which of course DHS never followed up with. Final report was issued October 2009. Dr. Cohn issued a notice of intent to deny. Nurse Glick sought administrative review, which was once the administrative judge decided he had jurisdiction and limited the scope of the hearing to whether they abused its discretion, he of course simply affirmed the decision. Nurse Glick had the right to appeal that to the Court of Appeals, but that would be futile, so we did not. We've exhausted all of the remedies other than a legislative solution. And on his behalf, on behalf of all Oregonians, using it isn't, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, that there aren't patients who are enrolled in the medical marijuana program who are using it for PTSD. They're lucky enough to have other qualifying conditions, but there are patients, including but not exclusively combat veterans.
I ask you to wrap it up.
I am wrapping up. Thank you.
I didn't tell.
I'm sorry. There I'm asking on behalf of combat veterans and others who don't suffer from listed debilitating medical conditions to be able to get the protection of the Medical Marijuana Act so they can't be arrested, prosecuted, have their property forfeited, and be imprisoned for their therapeutic use of medical cannabis to treat PTSD, that this committee send this to the House with a due pass recommendation and passed out of the Senate, and we ask that this committee move the bill forward. I appreciate your patience with me. Thank you, Chair Greenlee.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is my name is Anthony Taylor, and I'm the director of Compassionate Oregon, and I am in a Representative Boquist district and Representative Widener. I'm sorry, Senator Boquist and Representative Widener district. I'm going to defer my testimony to call-in testimony, so that you know time is short. So I'm going to defer.
Okay.
Should we call him again?
You want two call-ins? We'll do that, and then we'll do Representative Olson next. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I want to try and get everybody to have a little chance at least.
Mr. Chair, while he's dialing, I have a question for the attorney. On page 2, line 3, or line 6, it adds distribution to the current law. Is there a reason why we had to add distribution to it?
Representative Widener, Chair Greenlick, I don't have the bill in front of me. I'm not...
Medical use of marijuana means production, right. Possession, and delivery, and then we added distribution or administration of marijuana.
I can tell you that, Representative Widener, Chair Greenlick, that's something that happened by Legislative Council, and it wasn't something that we had requested as a part of this. Apparently, Legislative Council thought it was necessary. I'm primarily a criminal lawyer, and in Oregon, there is no separate crime for distribution. There's a law for delivery, which is the actual or attempted transfer of controlled substances.
Okay, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
This is Brian Crump. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Please go with your testimony and try and hold it to around 2 minutes.
Okay. As I said, I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I helped to draft the medical cannabis law we have here, and I helped to get PTSD added as an indication to our medical cannabis program. I currently manage probably somewhere close to 1,000 patients in our medical cannabis program who have PTSD. It has proven to be not only the most effective medication for treating PTSD, but it's the only medication that effectively treats all three of the major symptom clusters we see with PTSD. Dysfunction of the, we have a very complex system of receptors in our bodies called cannabinoid receptors. We also produce our own cannabinoids to help stimulate those receptors called endocannabinoids. We actually have new evidence that just was released yesterday. A new study came out published in the journal Molecular Psychiatry. The title of the article is Elevated Brain Cannabinoid CB1 Receptor Availability and Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, a Positron Emission Tomography Study. And what they found in this study, they looked at patients who are diagnosed with PTSD, and they find very real changes in the way the endocannabinoid functions in PTSD patients. They suggest that cannabis may be one of the most effective treatments for treating PTSD, cannabinoid-based medicines. In my own practice, I have found cannabis to be very consistently beneficial in helping with PTSD symptoms. A lot of my patients still need to have other medication treatment, but I find that cannabis is better tolerated and more consistently beneficial than any other medication available. The only FDA-approved medications that we have available for treating PTSD are Zoloft and Paxil, which are highly ineffective and in many cases actually make patients more suicidal. We know from previous brain imaging studies that there are dysfunctions in the endocannabinoid system that are involved in suicidal behavior.
Suicide is something that's very common among PTSD patients, and I have many patients who have reported that cannabis is the only medication that has effectively alleviated chronic suicidality that they have carried through many years of their lives. As I said, this is the safest and by far the most effective medication available for treating PTSD. I do have a paper that I have pending publication. It has been accepted in the practice journal for my field, which is called the Nurse Practitioner, and it is due to be released sometime within the next few months. And I'm very familiar with the neurobiological processes involved in PTSD. As I said, I have over 1,000 patients, or somewhere close to 1,000 patients that I manage right now for PTSD in the medical cannabis program, and I found it to be very effective. I would strongly encourage the legislature of Oregon to pass or to approve PTSD as an indication for your program there, and I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has any questions for me.
We appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Well, let's get, can we excuse you, and let's get Representative Olson, then we'll make the next call. Thank you very much, guys. Ms. Taylor, thanks for giving us a little time. Representative Olson?
No. This all squared away for you, sir. It's going to be short. Yes, good. Sir.
You've been listening.
That's right. Representative Green, or Chair Greenlight and Committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm a member of the House and represent the Albany area. But I would just like to have you consider the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 281. And the reasoning behind that is I have been involved with a number of work groups over the last few years dealing with medical marijuana. And I just want to quickly tell you that I am a big supporter of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act and the program itself. But I understand that there's some serious abuse that's going on right now, the last few years here in the state. I also know that there are a lot of patients out there that need to have the medical marijuana accessible to them, and I want to create that avenue. But we have two bills right now that we're dealing with. That one of those bills that you moved to Ways and Means, which is House Bill 3460, that essentially legalizes it for recreational use. And then the other one that came out of my committee in Judiciary a few weeks back, and that's House Bill 3371, which is down in revenue. And that deals with taxation and creates dispensaries. The only reason that I would like to have you do this and think and consider adding the Dash 5s to this bill right now is to create a work group. My reasoning behind that is right now we don't know where the federal government's going to be and where they're going to land eventually with what's happening in Washington and Colorado. I would like to be able to learn from them and have a work group and then move forward. When 2014 comes, we would have a bill that would work extremely well for Oregon and hit the ground running then come 2014 session. That's the reason why I come forth with this right now. And I just leave it to you.
Why do we need a bill for this? I mean, why don't we just do a work group? We're joining between this committee and the Judiciary.
Well, you know, I had that discussion with the Speaker, too, last week regarding that, too, and you could do a work group, but I guess the reasoning behind it is that this clearly gives direction from the legislators anyways, that we are interested. We have some concern with the other bills that are on the table right now here in this building, and we feel at this point right now this might be the better path to travel.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification for the record. I don't think House Bill 3460 legalized marijuana for recreational use. Is that what you thought?
3460?
Yeah.
Yes.
It didn't. It was around distribution for medical marijuana. It was setting up a distribution system for medical marijuana. So I don't think anyone on this committee voted
it was the dispensary
for recreational use. doesn't mean that people might not in the future, but yeah.
The argument was, in fact, that it gives you a place to use the excess marijuana that's grown so it doesn't get into the black market. Is the theory at any rate.
For the record, I'm supportive of a work group. Just wanted to make sure if anyone's listening out there.
Okay. Yeah, I think I am too. I mean, whether we pass this or not, I think we should have a work group between us and judiciary to get ready for the February session to do the kind of things you're talking about here.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for being here. Okay, one more phone call, and who will be after that?
Charles McPherson, Neil Feldman, and Don Esch.
Okay.
I'm going to call in Michael Kravitz.
Why don't you guys come up while we listen to the phone call? You may want to move over a little to Hi, this is House Committee on Health Care. And if you'd introduce yourself and give your testimony, please.
Yes, Michael Kravitz. I am Executive Director of Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access.
And if you'd please try and keep it to about 2 minutes, we're running very late.
Yes, I'll do my best.
Thank you. Go for it.
As I said, I'm Executive Director of Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access. I am a disabled United States Air Force veteran myself, and I thank you for allowing me to speak in support of Senate Bill 281. I was lucky enough, after about 10 years of working on pain management policy within the VA, to be in a position to actually negotiate with the VA on the first ever medical marijuana policy that was passed in the VA in 2010, allowing for veterans to use medical marijuana. They did so after being connected with the California Medical Cannabis Research Group and their double-blind placebo-based studies, some of them done at VA hospitals. And that policy, while it specifically allows veterans to use medical marijuana, it also specifically prohibits doctors at the VA from bringing the subject up or writing recommendations. So they really do lean on you. The VA is leaning on the state to take the lead on medical marijuana issues and then pass them back to the VA, where they then have a policy in place to handle the medical records and to further counsel the patient, assist in many ways. I think it's important to point out that my colleague Brian Crum talked about some of the medications for post-traumatic stress approved and used off-label. It's important to recognize that the Army Surgeon General recently came out with a memo saying that these drugs, even the best ones that are actually approved, aren't very good. The ones that aren't approved aren't worth the risk, and that's pretty much a direct quote. I think it's also important to recognize that not allowing post-traumatic stress as a condition listed in the state program, while allowing for pain, which pain is actually a common symptom of post-traumatic stress, rightfully causes the pain indication to be overloaded, raises red flags for law enforcement. You've heard that before. I want to add that it also creates a stigma and adds to the stigma and helps to hurt those that are trying to get veterans in to seek treatment as I do. We're trying to reduce the stigma and tell them that it's a regular medical condition, it can be treated, and what are you telling them by your not allowing it to be approved as a condition with overwhelming evidence? Absolutely. The Fox News that Brian Crum talked about, the headline of the news show was the first ever evidence-based treatment for post-traumatic stress. And they're doing that for brain scans where they show this deficit in cannabinoids that is being filled by cannabis, and then allowing the veteran to sleep, get rid of the nightmares so they can get through the night, reduce some of the hypervigilance. It's a nightmare state that you live in with post-traumatic stress. And we know at best that it works. But I'll tell you, as a national advocate, what really sways me more even is the families and the friends of the veteran that tell me that it improves their life. So we need you to take a lead. Sorry, I'm kind of emotional. It's just I don't suffer from post-traumatic stress myself, but I read every day of the loss of our fellow vets who died because they can't get the help they need, and that's just unacceptable. Cannabis helps. It helps. Please do what you can to put it in the hands of those who need it and not have a fake jail for using the medicine that gives them
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. Can we?
Brad begin, sir?
Please.
My name is Captain Eugene F. Ebersole. I was a U.S. Navy Judge Advocate General for 30 years. I was also a U.S. Army soldier and from 1968 to 1970 and served a tour of Vietnam in Cochin and Lai Kha. After I became a lawyer, after I got out of the Navy, I became, in 1989, Assistant Attorney General to David Frohnmeyer and worked for the Oregon Department of Justice for 21 years. I've suffered from PTSD since I got back from Vietnam, and it took me until after I came back from Iraq in December of 2009 before I had was a man enough, and it's like alcoholism, there's a stigma attached to being a PTSD vet. People think we're crazy. And it worked pretty well for me as a lawyer because I was pretty aggressive and I was very successful, as Dr. Representative Kennemer knows. I spent a lot of time in these hallowed halls passing a lot of legislation, 20 years in consumer protection, and a year after I got back from Iraq in the criminal justice section at the Department of Justice's worst little stint of history. But I come to you today because I am also carrying a second shadow over me that I sometimes fear because of being raised in the shadow of reefer madness and inappropriate attitudes towards cannabis. And that is that when I got out of the Oregon Department of Justice and had to go from my state health insurance, I had to rely upon TRICARE. I was lucky enough to get a doctor who was an ex-Air Force flight surgeon with multiple tours of combat in Afghanistan treating veterans or treating soldiers. And she was the one that recommended that I get a cannabis certification. I'm 100% disabled. I'm blessed that I don't have the disabilities that would stop me from participating in what appears to be a normal life. But I can tell you that I have a great deal of help from having the ability to have medical marijuana at my disposition, because the VA, we have a really lucky in the Northwest. The Oregon VA can't be beat, and the feds had done a great job handling the caseload here. But we have a lot of veterans coming home.
I ask you to wrap it up.
And I want to make sure that you don't get stuck in the quagmire, as I've learned in this house, that if you attach this bill, this simple, very simple piece of legislation to some other thing and put it in a working group and send it to another place, it can vanish very easily. And I don't want that to happen. I want you to just take this very simple piece of legislation and say, PTSD, medical marijuana, it's a good match. It works. Please do a due pass. Take all that other stuff and let it carry with the legalization for the bigger bills. This is a small thing to help vets. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Ash. I'm a combat veteran from Vietnam, and I've been suffering for 40 years. This is hard for me to talk about this. I get kind of upset, but I suffered for 40 years. With nightmares, hypervigilance, tough to have relationships with PTSD, we suffer in silence, you know, and there are many suicides now because of this PTSD. It's a tough way to live. I wouldn't wish this on anybody. And I just urge you to pass SB 281. For the veterans and everyone that has PTSD, please pass that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Yes, sir. Yes, my name is Neil Feldman. I'm a resident of Salem. I'm in Representative Clem's district and Senator Courtney's. I am a Navy vet. I used to be not in the chair. I don't have PTSD myself, but I do know a lot of vets that do. I think that it's absolutely astounding and unconscionable that PTSD was not put on in the first place, but that also the DHS, then OHA, whatever they want to call themselves, has basically put every roadblock under the sun into doing this very simple thing. And I agree with the gentleman over here. It's a very simple bill. So I made a comment to Mr. Larson there that it was one page. You don't see that often. I'd really like it to stay that way. It's a good bill. It's a needed bill. I have friends of mine, like I said, who have PTSD. Many of them have attempted suicide. So far, luckily with me, nobody has succeeded. But it's ridiculous that the people that we owe the most to, our veterans, they're dying right now faster back home than they are in combat. And there's just no reason for that. But also, I have friends of mine who have PTSD, several of them from criminal acts against them, one of them from spousal abuse. And so I don't want to just limit it to veterans, but it should be available to everybody. Cannabis is extremely effective in treating PTSD. I am myself an Oregon medical marijuana patient for pain and various other issues, not PTSD, but it's always angered me anytime anybody that I know seeks to get on the on the OMMP. What do they have? Oh, we have PTSD. Oh, that's not covered. Sorry, go away. Go get thrown in jail or something, because most of them end up treating themselves anyway. But they go through the black market, lack of quality, lack of safety. I mean, not only from the medicine, but also just the situation is not very safe for them. And by doing this, they have to put their freedom and liberty at risk to have any sort of decent health. And I agree with the other person who testified earlier that pretty much most of the drugs are dangerous garbage and they do more harm than good. Most everyone I know that's taken any of them, Zoloft, Cymbalta, any of them, they end up becoming extremely suicidal. And when you're already suicidal at that point, it doesn't help. But thank you very much. I very strongly urge a upvote, no amendments, no nonsense, just a due pass to the floor. Thank you.
Did I miss somebody on the list? Okay, well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, Charles McPherson was supposed to be here, but apparently he wasn't able to make it.
Let me, folks, we're going to work this Friday. Tyler, would you let the rest of the folks who aren't here now know? We'll have next Friday off, which will extend the weekend. I've already got approval for that. So
the following Friday, you mean?
The following Friday, yeah. This Friday we'll work. We have a long, long agenda. A week from Friday we'll be off, and you can announce both of those things if you let the other folks know.
Okay.
I'm going to close the public hearing on on Senate Bill 281. If you all would let me know what your wishes are on this one, we'll carry it over to Friday. If you please carry over the a work session on 281 for this Friday. We're going to have a really long agenda on Friday, the same kind of too many people to testify. What we don't do, we'll carry over the following Monday, but let's try and do whatever we can. And work session possible on this on Friday. Any comments, discussion?
Started working this in 2002.
We are adjourned.
We still don't.
Thank you all for your patience.
A control.